This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, Case 201. Bodhidharma's skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. The main case. Venerable Bodhidharma was about to go back to India. He said to his students, "The time has come. How do you express your understanding?" The student Dalfu said, "My present view is that we should neither be attached to letters nor be apart from letters and allow the way to function freely." Bodhidharma said, "You've attained my skin." The nun Dzongchur said, "My view is that it's like the joy of seeing Akshobhya, Buddha's land, just once and not again." Bodhidharma said, "You've attained my flesh." Dao Yu said, "The four great elements are originally empty, and the five skandhas don't exist. Therefore, I see nothing to be attained." Bodhidharma said, "You've attained my bones." Finally, Zen Master Dazu Huike came forward, made a full bow, stood up, and returned to where he was. Bodhidharma said, "You've attained my marrow." And thus he transmitted the Dharma in the robe to Huike. The commentary. If you take these different responses as being superior or inferior to each other, you've missed Bodhidharma's intention. We should realize that although each disciple's expression of the Dharma is different from the others, nonetheless, each, in his or her own way, contains the teacher's whole being. Given that Bodhidharma is not approving depth of understanding by the use of the terms skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, who did he transmit the Dharma to? If you say all four received the Dharma, then why is it said that thus he transmitted the Dharma in robe to Huike? If you're able to see into it here, you'll understand the heart of Bodhidharma. Verse. Before a step is taken, you've already arrived. Before a word is spoken, the truth has been expressed. So this being our Bodhidharma session, I was called upon to bring forth a teaching of Bodhidharma. And so, as most of you know, is considered the beginning of the Zen tradition, a meditation master from India who traveled to China in around 400s, and had a very important encounter with Emperor Wu, who was the emperor at that time, who had come to power in a merciless way, murder and intrigue, but then it had a change of heart. Why does it happen after? Why not before? But he had a change of heart, became a very devoted practitioner, as well as supporter of Buddhism. It said that he even built a monastery, a small monastery, attached to the palace, and that he would disappear into that monastery just to practice and train. And they would have to, you know, give him some amount of time, and then they'd have to kind of go in and get him and pull him back out so he could do his emperor duties. And that after Bodhidharma's encounter with Emperor Wu, which is part of the Koan collection, he then went to Shaolin Monastery and sat facing a wall for 9 years. And so this koan takes up the moment when either he was getting ready to die or to leave and go back to India. It's not known. Both are put forth in the stories of Bodhidharma, of which there's, you know, there's historical evidence that of this person and of different aspects of his story, but of course there's a lot that isn't known because it was so long ago. It's said that there were repeated attempts on his life from other spiritual groups. And so one version is that finally he just succumbed. He allowed himself to succumb to being poisoned because he had chosen to end his life at that time. as Dharma masters are known to do at times. The other version is that he went back to India. And so another version incorporates both of those, where he did allow himself to be poisoned. He died. And then a monk was wandering through the mountains and came upon Bodhidharma. And in conversation, Bodhidharma said that he was heading back to India. And he was holding a sandal in his hand. And so when the monk came back and told everybody about this, because Bodhidharma had died, they opened up his tomb, and in fact, there was nothing inside except one shoe. And so you can choose the version that suits your taste. So here, Bodhidharma is leaving one way or another, and he's saying to his students, the time has come, can you express your understanding? And these four disciples are in the records as having studied with Bodhidharma and having succeeded him. The time has come. The teacher is always concerned, it's part of their vow, is concerned for a student's past, present, and future. You know, as students, generally, we can be very concerned about our future, about the future of our present circumstances, our practice, our lives. And of course, that's where everything is happening, is in this present moment. And at the same time, we are on a path that is opening up before us in directions we don't know yet. And that we also need to be concerned about that, because otherwise our attention to the moment becomes myopic. It becomes too confined. And that's the whole part of the purpose of a path, is that there's a sense of moving forward, and that there's some sense of what that forward direction is. And so the teacher is always thinking about that. Dadaroshi thought about that, I think, from very close to the beginning of his time here. When things were still very much being established, he was already thinking about, you know, beyond him. And both if he were to die suddenly, as well as if he were to just die, you know, after a long tenure. Because that's part of the role of the teacher, is to be concerned and be training students and making provisions both for now but also for the future, so that there is a future, that there is a sangha in the future, that in which, or a place in which a sangha can gather. To transmit the lamp is what Bodhidharma is concerned with here. The light, the transmission of the light, is in a sense already happened. That's within each one of us. But transmitting the lamp is how it continues from one generation to the next. In Mazumi Roshi's, what was considered to be, was taken to be Mazumi Roshi's death poem, at the end, he said, life after life, rebirth after rebirth, practice diligently. Do not regress. Don't let the wisdom seed of the Buddha's ancestors be discontinued. Thus, I deeply implore you. And this is a very beautiful way of expressing exactly that. I implore you. And so here, each of these students was asked to come forward and express their understanding. Why is that important? That comes up, you know, in a teaching that is said to have originated from Bodhidharma, where he said that Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures with no reliance on words and letters. Why is Bodhidharma asking each student to come forward and express? And this is really important, I mean, for all kinds of reasons. But it's, you know, it helps us to clarify our own understanding when we express that understanding. It's very easy to have a sense within ourselves of what we understand relative to anything, really, certainly in relation to the Dharma. But then when we're suddenly called upon to speak, to express it, then we see how clear we are. And that's really helpful. It helps us to see that. You know, whenever a senior is giving a first talk, you know, I was just talking to Geekon recently, and I said, because he gave his first talk here in December session, I wasn't here. And I said, have you listened to your talk yet? And he responded the way almost every single senior has always responded. No. Like, I haven't listened to it. As in, I'm not going to listen to it. Don't make me listen to it. And I always say, look, it's a really good teaching tool. It's a good training tool to listen to yourself. You can let some time pass, you know. But listen to it. I said, everybody else has listened to it. If you know, you should be able to listen to it. But it's really good to just hear ourselves, which is, of course, the very thing we're reluctant to do, but to hear ourselves and just see, how did this come across? Was I clear? So come forward and express your understanding. So Dao Fu comes forward and says, my present view is that we should neither be attached to letters nor apart from letters. Allow the way to function freely. Beyond words and meaning, but not apart from words and meaning. Buddhism doesn't, there is no extinguishing. Samsara is not something that is to be eradicated. In a very real sense, it is to be deeply appreciated, deeply understood. In a certain sense, I say respected because it has so much power. Not respected in the sense of may you continue endlessly, but in the sense of I see how powerful you, that is me, my mind, my karmic patterns, my attachments are. So much more powerful than I ever imagined. In a sense, so much of training is just continually being turned back into the depth and the breadth of our own self. There's nothing in this universe that separates anything from anything. And so this dynamic, we can think of it as a tension between the conceptual and the non-conceptual. But really, that's just until we've realized that they're not two. And then there is no tension. Bodhidharma says, you have attained my skin. Then the Nangzong Chur says, my view is that it's like the joy of seeing Akshobhya, Buddha's land, just once and not again. So Dzongchur, as you know, is one of the women ancestors. We chant her name today. She was actually a child of Emperor Wu, was a daughter of his, and so grew up in this very sort of deep Buddhist environment. And when she was 19, she wanted to be ordained, which is a year earlier than was normal. And he said, yes. And so she spent some years in monasteries, but she was disillusioned and upset with the institutionalization of Buddhism, how it was not really alive. And so she went wandering, seeking a teacher, and she found Bodhidharma and studied with him and then succeeded him. Afterwards, she traveled and eventually settled and became a teacher, an important teacher in her own right, and had many students with a heavy emphasis on sitting. And it said that she heard that the new Emperor Wu's successor, had outlawed Buddhism in one of the flips from supporting to oppressing Buddhism, and ordered all of the nuns and monks to return to lay life. And she said, it's said that she said, your skin, your flesh, your bones and marrow are part of the great body of the earth, and it's all running with blood. Bodhidharma said, you have attained my flesh. Akshobhya is the Buddha of the Pure Land, of the Western Pure Land. And it dates from one of the earliest Pure Land texts. And in his original or early incarnation, he made a vow to have no anger or ill will towards any living being until enlightenment. Wonder how long that took. And so he's Akshobhya means the immovable one. And so he was immovable within that vow. And so Dzongchur says, my present view, it's like the joy of seeing this Buddha just once and never again. What is it to see something once and never again? It never repeats itself. What is to see it this way? So that time drops away just once. No before or after, never to return. No precedent. Never arriving, never departing. It's like the joy of coming upon a cool, clear lake when you're dying of thirst. Bodhidharma says, you've attained my flesh. Then Tao Yu says, the four great elements, earth, air, fire, and water, our physicality, our solidity, our winds, our air, energy, our fire, and our liquidity, our solvency, are empty. And the five skandhas don't exist. Therefore, I see nothing to be attained. Attaining non-attainment. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. Somebody wrote me recently about one of these vows and said that they're confusing. They're not so much confusing as they are disturbing. Right? They seem to contradict themselves. They seem to, how can we attain what is unattainable? Exactly. That's exactly right. These are not just clever words. They're not just trying to confuse us. They're actually trying to make things very clear for us. There's the koan of the Buddha Supreme Wisdom who sat on the kalpa seat, on the bodhi seat for endless kalpas. The student wants to know, why didn't this Buddha attain it? And the teacher says, excellent question. And the student says, no, really, why didn't the Buddha attain it? And the teacher says, because the Buddha did not attain. And we can understand that. Well, it can't be attained. We already possess Buddha nature. It's not outside. That's true, but it doesn't change our lives. Therefore, I see nothing to be attained. Bodhidharma says, you've attained my bones. And then finally, Huaca comes up, does a full bow, stands and returns to his place. Bodhidharma says, you have attained my marrow. What is he presenting? Wordlessly, he reveals all. This is the lion drawer. The study of this koan is really true with all koans. A student has to enter into the mind of each of these students, presenting their understanding. We have to meet each of them there, which means we have to leave our own personal thinking, karmic, historical, self-identifying mind aside and enter into their mind, meet them in their own understanding. And all the koans are like that. Sometimes we meet the student's delusion. We meet their pride. We meet their fear of death. We meet their arrogance. We meet their blindness. Sometimes we're not sure what we're meeting in what they're presenting. Is this clarity or is this blindness? The koan doesn't tell you that. It's the student's role to enter into that and see. And Bodhidharma says, you've attained my marrow, and then transmitted the Dharma, the robe, to Huaca. So the tradition up to that point was that in transmission or empowering a student, that there would be some physical object that would symbolize that. And so in present day, there's the 7-foot staff, which is in the Doksan Daisan room. There's the kutz. There's the bell, the handbell, there's the bowl, the Buddha's bowl, these various objects which are symbols of having received that empowerment. At various times there was a portrait of one's teacher that one received as an indication of that. Up to this point, it was said that the bowl and robe of Bodhidharma was transmitted to Hueca and then was transmitted for some period of time until that was no longer done. But the robe and bowl are still transmitted. They're just not, they are Huecas, but they're just a newer make. So Bodhidharma says, you have attained my bones. Now, the natural way to understand this is that each of these students is presenting their understanding, which is successively deeper, skin, flesh, bones, marrow, which means each student's understanding is successively more profound or more clear. But Dada Roshi says, if you take these different responses as being superior or inferior to each other, then we missed Bodhidharma's intention. We should realize that each of their expressions of the Dharma is different from the others. Nevertheless, each in their own way contains the whole of the teacher's being. How are we to understand this? There is what we could call our relative capacity, our our human capacity that we bring forward into practice. And then there is our fundamental capacity. We're all Buddhas. We all have enlightened nature. The Buddha realized that, was liberated in that realization from suffering, and then essentially transmitted the realization of that through the enlightenment experience of each successive generation. That's what's transmitted, which is why transmission itself is misleading in the sense that it conveys that something is conveyed or given, whereas what's attained is non-attainment. What is realized is that which is not given, is not a thing. Within our relative capacity, there is our own karma, the actions of our lives and their consequences, the experiences, all the totality of experiences that we've had within our own life, our own mind and body, the mind and body that we live in, that we inhabit, our access to the teachings and a teacher, our own faith, patience, our discipline, our ability to actually practice, the conditions of our life circumstances, our motivation, the support of our life that encourages us to practice or doesn't, the support of our life and the culture we live in that supports us to actually be or doesn't. All of these are part of our relative capacity in the sense that they're all impacting us, having influence. They've all become part of our identity, the way we see ourselves, the way we see the world. They will all of those manifest in our mind as thoughts and emotions, the way we see and hear things. And they're different in every person. So, certain things may seem like advantages, you know, that there are things that would be obvious advantages towards raising bodhicitta, towards being able to practice and realize oneself. And oftentimes they are, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes those aren't advantages. Sometimes they actually become obstacles. Other things that might really seem to be disadvantages or deficiencies in a person's life, in the culture they live within, in their circumstances, in they themselves. And sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. It's like, how are they used? How do we use all that we have? In a sense, training is teaching us how to use the universal, Buddha nature, and the particular, our karma, and the world we live in, our particular world. To liberate ourselves. So that what in the beginning can seem like we have very little to work with and just an insurmountable mountain of obstacles begins to transform, and we realize that that the most important thing, in a sense, was settled in the beginning, Buddha nature. And that those obstacles, over time, hopefully, right, with a lot of diligence and support and time and patience, become more and more useful, able to be used. Dogen speaks about this. Go on. He says, know that Bodhidharma's words, skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, don't mean that one understanding is deeper than another. Even if there are superior or inferior views, even if there are different, you know, depths of understanding, in the ancestral way, there's only attaining the self. This means that neither the phrase, you have attained my marrow, nor the phrase, you have attained my bones, is more essential than the other for guiding a person in holding up grass or dropping grass. It's like holding up a flower, transmitting a robe. From the beginning, Bodhidharma's confirmation of each one was equal. Although his confirmation was equal, the four views weren't necessarily equal. And this is where it is a koan. His confirmation was equal, but their views were not. How are we to understand that? You know, it's important, significant that there are, you know, different, so many different references to this essentially in the teachings. Master Honen was giving a teisho. He points to the blinds, and two students walk over and raise them up alike. And Master Honen says, one has it and one has not. Master Zhaozhou goes to two hermits. Are you in? Both raise their fist alike. Master Zhaozhou says, one is shallow, no place to anchor a boat here. The other is, you are deep and vast. So this sense of shallow and deep, superficial and profound, realize and not realize, comes up over and over again. Why? Because that's a place where we get hooked. And it's also something that needs to be understood. Although his confirmation was equal, the four views were not necessarily equal. How in this do we find ourselves? How do we find our peace? How do we find our understanding? What does depth of understanding mean? You know, why, when somebody has seen their self nature, don't they just, you know, pack up their bags, go home, and live their enlightened life forever? What is enlightenment? What have they seen? Right? If they've seen their self nature, then they have seen what everyone has seen. So what does it mean to see it deeply or not deeply? What does it mean to have integrated it or to have not integrated it in how we live? You know, whether understanding is superficial or deep, that's not a value judgment on the person. It's not a criticism or praise. You know, that when I would go in working on a koan and to see my teacher and I present my understanding, and particularly at the beginning, my teacher would say, no, that's not it. What I heard was, you idiot. You good for nothing. Get out of my face. Stop bothering me. Why are you wasting my time? That's what I heard, right? Of course, he didn't say anything like that. All he said was, not yet. And I had to find my way through that and realize when I walked back to my seat in my own misery and then realize, what did he say? And I realize what is happening is there is something that is not clear. I want it to be clear. There is something that I haven't yet fully inhabited. I want to inhabit that. Dogen says, "Now to receive the seal of you have attained my skin by having the eye of studying is to fully attain the ancestor." To receive you have attained my skin, Dogen is saying, is to have the eye of studying you have attained my skin, which is to fully attain the ancestor. To attain the ancestor is to meet the Buddha. Dogen says, there is an ancestor whose body, full body is skin, an ancestor whose full body is flesh, whose full body is bones, whose full body is marrow. There's an ancestor whose full body is mind, whose full body is body, whose full mind is mind. There's an ancestor whose full ancestor is ancestor. And there's an ancestor whose full body is attaining myself, yourself. One word. Whose whole body and mind is, I attain myself, yourself. Your very body is entirely flesh. Bodhidharma said, your body is the real body. Your real body is the mind of Buddha. Even before, Bodhidharma says, you have attained my skin, my flesh, my bones, my marrow. This is so. Realizing this is the long path. Actualizing this at every step along the way, before realization, practicing our realization before realization is the Buddha Dharma. What does that mean? How can you practice your enlightenment before you're enlightened? By being an enlightened being. Do what enlightened beings do. Well, what do enlightened beings do? They cease from harm. They practice good. They study and realize mind. They question. They examine. They persevere. They start over billions and billions and billions of times. They give up and they start again. They cultivate loving kindness and compassion. They see the whole earth as their own body and mind. Realizing this and actualizing this at every step along the way is what our path is. That's what it means to practice. It doesn't mean, you know, it's like when you when you start learning something, a new skill, to draw, to play an instrument, to ski, to, you know, write poetry, to be a school teacher, to be a parent. So in the beginning, we don't know what that is yet, right? We're here to learn, and so we enter into study. At what point do you become the parent, the school teacher, right? A person who plays a musical instrument? At what point do we become that thing? When we think of it in terms of identity, you'll have to, you know, whatever you decide, or maybe whatever other people decide, is when you become that thing. But how about when it's not about identity? Not about building the self. So that's why we practice from the very beginning. So when we give beginning instruction, you know, the senior is saying, you know, you fold your legs like this, and then you mudra, and you straighten your back, and then you bring your attention to the breath. But if you translated all of that, right, that's just language that everybody understands. But if you translated it, the translation would be, you are Buddha. That's it. Now, live that. Be that very thing that we are. Next Sunday, we're beginning Ango, and the theme is manifesting Buddha. kind of covers it all. Right? Doesn't leave anything out. Manifesting Buddha. And the fascicle, we're going to be, I'll be talking more about this next week, so I'll refrain today. There's a sequel to this. It's next week. You have to come. So manifesting Buddha, it's exactly that. It's exactly that, manifesting this that we already are, right? Which is why, you know, we are an evidence-based practice, which means when we are deluded and living out of deluded, of our delusion, on one level or another, it hurts. Just very simply, it hurts. Period. And when we're living, and that's whether we're, you know, on top of the mountain or down in the cave. When we're living out of our enlightened nature, the hurt begins to diminish. And that, again, is regardless of where we are. To cease from harm, to bring benefit to others, and study and realize mind. We live within a world and a culture that is based on views. Right? That's why the Buddha started with right understanding. We all come loaded with views, beliefs, ways we see the world. Most of them we don't even see. We don't know we have because they're just the world. They're not our views. They're not my views. They're just the way the world is. I look out and that's what I see. The world looks back and confirms. But then how do we explain that everybody's experience of the world is different? Even you, if you have siblings, your own siblings, right? Like, tell a story that seems absolutely factual and see what happens. I mean, even knowing this, even having studied the Dharma, I'm still staggered within my own family, where I will say, remember when, and they, my siblings look at me like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, no way, you can't not know that this is what happened. That this is the definitive version of what happened. And they're like, I don't even know what you're talking about. How do we explain that? More important than how do we explain that, how do we live it? How do we live within it? Well, a lot of the time, not so well. Not so well. The Dharma is the reality of what we call natural laws, immutable laws, inviolate laws. Right? You can ignore them at your own risk, at your own peril. And those laws inhabit our whole being, and they inhabit every system, every object, in every time, in every place. That's what it means to be immutable. They're not a result of anybody voting them in. They can't be opted in or out of. They're just the way things are in this realm, in this world. When we live within them in accord, then life flourishes. And it flourishes in very particular ways, in non-greed, in non-ill will, in non-delusion. And those become more and more the norm. Normal. Normal. Just like the more we practice letting go of attachments and actually being aware, that becomes normal. It's not a big deal. It's normal. In the beginning, distractedness is normal because that's what we've cultivated. But when we, and this means everybody, Buddhist and non-Buddhist alike, when we don't live in accord with the Dharma, because the Dharma fundamentally is not Buddha Dharma, just means the Dharma as taught by the Buddha. But the Dharma that the Buddha taught is fundamentally these essential immutable laws. When we don't live in accord with them, then life is not flourishing. And greed and conflict and delusion become the norm. And of course, this is, we see this. Both sides, we see this. And then that gets passed on from one generation to the next, from one generation to the next. That's our inheritance. And so there is original nature and there is what we could call our inherited and created capacity in nature. Rumi said in his appropriately well-known poem, "Sit, be still, listen. You're drunk, and we're all sitting at the edge of the roof." How could he have known those words spoken so long ago would be so much more true? More drunk we are, more not being, not sitting still, not listening, sitting more at the edge of the roof. So what is manifesting Buddha? Right? So I really want us to look at this. And so next week, we'll, as we begin the Ango, we'll follow that. I'll speak about this more, but we'll follow that with this forum that we're having on that, where the Beyond Fear of Difference people, group, that has been involved in this work for many years and much more intensively of late, in latter years, is going to be bringing forth to the Sangha the work that we've been doing, and also, most importantly, inviting you, the Sangha, to engage in this, which is really about manifesting Buddha. It's about how do we live in this world in which every world appears to be different from every place. And that's not an accident. Conditioning is not an accident. Our desires are not accidents. The things we attach to are not accidents. They're willful. They're based in intention. And when those desires become institutionalized, and in our country institutionalized in virtually every institution we have, what does that mean as a Buddhist practitioner? What does it mean to manifest Buddha? For whom? You know, the depth of this teaching and tradition that we've inherited that is so profound and so incredibly timely. I mean, it got here just in time. and yet, as is true with anything that's powerful, some of the very aspects of its power can become traps. And this is not just true in Buddhism, it's true in every religious tradition that has power. And so, what does it mean to manifest Buddha? And in particular, I mean, in every way, because that's the life of Bodhisattva, is to not cordon off different aspects of our lives, but in the particular ways that we have been studying here over the years, in terms of race bias, gender bias, all forms of oppression, in terms of our weeping earth. What does it mean? And not just for us, but for tomorrow. Right? That's the view we need to have. There has to be that fierce urgency of now that Dr. King spoke about so and made his life about. But there also has to be the long path. And so please come next week. We're going to be live streaming this. Yeah. That's really important. So no matter where you are, if you can't be here, I really implore you to come or to watch it. Because I really feel like this work that we're doing and that it is not an aspect of what we do, but it is what we're doing, and it is manifesting Buddha, and it is today, and it is tomorrow. And I feel like, but for this, we ain't going to have much of a day tomorrow. And our practice is to be dedicated to the whole thing. And to doing all that we can to, in essence, create an enlightened society. I mean, are you up for that? right? You've all done difficult things in your lives. How about something really challenging? Right? Which you will not live to see the end of. But you can have a part. I'm in.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.